Welcome to Renegade Inc. It'll come as no surprise to you, our audience, that a recent poll indicated that economists are amongst the least trusted professionals. They've made blundering mistakes on everything from claiming financial crises can't happen to not foreseeing the most obvious recessions. But all that pales into insignificance when inept economists get involved in modelling climate science. A recession we can recover from, but the breakdown of our planet we cannot. We went to Kokonomics, the leading economics festival in Norway, to talk with the renegade economist Professor Steve Keen. He asserts that mainstream economists have been peddling their ideology as scientific fact. So, we wanted to understand the scale of the damage their blinkered ideology has done to the future of our planet. Welcome to Stavanger. Is that the correct pronunciation? You are one of a few, a handful, if you like, of economists who predicted the great financial crisis. And now you've seen something else in a very different area that gives you alarm. What is it and why should we be worried?
Well, it's economists trying to predict the economic impact of climate change, which is a worthy thing to do. But they've approached it, first of all, by believing that it will have very little impact. So they've gone looking for data which supports their argument that it will have very little impact. And they've committed the cardinal sin of economics, which is making what they call a simplifying assumption that I actually call a fantasy. There's many that they've done, but the most outrageous is the fantasy that the difference between different cities in America, let's say, or different states in America, in terms of temperature and GDP, which gives you a very weak relationship between the temperature of a state and its GDP per head, that can be used to predict the impact of climate change.
What then gives you the right, because you're not published in this area, you haven't addressed climate breakdown, your modelling has been in all sorts of financial areas, certainly not this. What gives you the right to talk
first
about
this? First thing is, one thing which has been left out of economics since the physiocrats, which predate Adam Smith.
Who are they?
Is the role of the economists in France, who, being in a rural environment, argued that all wealth comes from the free gift of nature,
right, which
we would call energy today. And Smith came along and said, no, it all comes from a division of labour.
Did the physiocrats see land as a unique factor of production?
Absolutely unique, because land is what receives what they call the free gift of nature, which we would call solar energy. Of course, you put it with one seed in the ground, you get 1,000 seeds and a plant coming out of it. There's an obvious way that something is being given to you for free by the nature. You then harvest that. That's where the wealth comes from, and that gets distributed through the rest of society. They didn't call it energy because the word didn't exist when they were writing, but fundamentally they're saying production is based upon the free gift of energy from the environment. We simply take that energy and convert it into useful work.
The neoclassical economist, which is the prevailing ideology today, has three factors of production: land, labour, capital. Do they take land? They must take land in as a unique factor.
They've left it out.
What?
They've left it out. Okay. They used to talk about it 40 years ago, but their fundamental model of production says production is a function of labour and capital. No role for land and no role for energy. And what I've done recently, which is why I've got into this field, is I've worked out in a very, very simple way how you can bring energy in. It's a simple insight that occurred to me is they were modelling output as, you know, machines and workers together. And walking through a friend's house, which is full of sculptures one day, the insight occurred to me: labour without energy is a corpse. Machinery without energy is a sculpture. To do work, they have to have energy input into them, and then that energy lets them convert that energy into a useful work, which we called income.
But so they're blindsided to this?
Yeah.
Or is it selective amnesia?
Blindsided, because this has been something which is not just neoclassicals have made this mistake. Post-Keynesians have, Marxists have, Austrians have. All schools of economics have omitted the role of energy. So it's a blindside which has been in economics for two centuries.
Why? I mean, because you can get conspiratorial at this point and say, well, someone's funding economics, so therefore we should actually...
No, it's actually just an oversight. It's ridiculously simple to bring energy in, saying rather than labour working and producing output, labour has to have food to produce output. Machines have to have energy input to produce output. It's a very simple mathematical insight, but that occurred to me in 2016. You have to go back to 1770 when economists were thinking about it in the same way. And for two centuries, we've been arguing over what produces wealth and value, leaving out the essential input of energy.
You've taken particular aim at an economist called William Nordhaus. Mm. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. Why has he incited such ire?
First of all, he is the individual who did most to disparage the reception of the Limits to Growth study back in 1972.
And what is that study?
And the Limits to Growth was a study by a group of computer scientists at MIT putting together a modelling framework that lets you look at the feedbacks between different parts of the very complex system of the world in which we're in, things like the level of population, the level of output, the amount of food being produced, the amount of pollution produced, the capacity of the planet to absorb that pollution, putting all those feedback effects together.
And they had that data?
They used data from 1900 to 1970 to calibrate their model. So they had indexes for production, indexes for pollution, and so on. They made sure their model reproduced, roughly speaking, the data from 1900 to 1970 and all those elements, and they simply ran it forward and saw what happened. And what that model predicted was that between 2030 and 2070, roughly in those periods, some form of crisis would strike, either a pollution crisis, a running out of irreplaceable resources crisis, one of multiple crises, unless we in the mid-1970s decided to limit population growth, to put more of our energy resources into generating non-carbon-based energy systems, more work into controlling pollution. If we'd done all these controls, we could have sustained the planet indefinitely.
What happened mid-70s?
Nordhaus wrote a paper called Measurement Without Data.
In the mid-70s?
In the mid-70s. He wrote it in 1972. So we're talking, he actually wrote it before, he criticised a predecessor of the Limits to Growth part, written by Jay Forrester, one of the world's great engineers. And that disparaged the whole study. So it had an enormous impact upon popular opinion. It sold about 25 million copies, but it was disparaged and thrown out. And economists rejected not just the conclusions of the study, but the methodology as well. Whereas the methodology, and I'm speaking having spoken to Rand as one of the authors here, they actually believe that economists would say, thank you for producing this methodology, because this methodology lets us analyse the economy out of equilibrium. And we've been analysing as if it's in equilibrium, which is obviously a fiction. So you've let us not have to make that stupid assumption of equilibrium, but thanks very much. Instead, the economists said, get out of here. We're hanging under our equilibrium assumption.
And is that because they want these simplifying assumptions? Describe more of these simplifying assumptions. How do they look? Because I've also heard you call them fantasy.
Yeah, well, I mean, my favourite fantasy is, there's many in economics, but a guy called Paul Samuelson. I imagine most of you heard Paul Samuelson's name. He once wrote, he doesn't care who writes a country's laws, so long as he can write his economics textbooks. Okay. You've all seen the market supply and demand curve, the intersecting lines. You've seen that image, okay. To explain the demand curve, they have a model which explains an individual having a fall in their demand as the price of something rises. They prove that using a little model. But then they have to add up all these individual demand curves to get a market demand
curve. So they just extrapolate that
out. Well, that's what they did. They extrapolated. And his argument was that inside a family, to actually get this extrapolation to work, inside a family, you have to assume that money is redistributed within the family so that this is a quote from Samuelson, the ethical worth of everybody's last dollar is equal. So a family acts as one big happy family and shuffles all the money together so everybody is equally happy and nobody inside the family complains about how many bananas one child got versus another. He said, one only has to assume the same model at a national level. So he assumes America is one big happy family.
It is.
That's literally in one of his articles.
It is, isn't it? Okay. That's what they tell
him. He called that a rigorous proof. Okay? rigor bloody mortis. So that was the basis. Let's assume America is one big happy family, and then we can explain a downward sloping demand curve.
So how do we relate that, because it's quite technical, to the layman, to me, to help me understand that when it comes to climate breakdown?
What they've done in climate change, they've assumed that the variation the very weak relationship we can now find between income in some part of America and the temperature in the same part of America, that will apply as we increase the temperature of the planet.
Right. So now, your salary or a median salary, is this what you're saying?
Yeah.
Across a state,
yep,
plus climate change have been put together.
As though they're interchangeable. The way they put it was that we assume that the variations in climate and income over space will occur over time. What they're assuming is, like you're in a mountain,
right,
and they're assuming we've got data about the slope of the mountain going north to south. We don't have data going east to west. So we assume the slope is the same in both directions. What could be wrong with that? If you're in El Capitan, you'll break your neck finding out the answer. And that's what they've done. Now, it's an insanely bad assumption. It's a stupid assumption.
Do they not see the absurdity in this?
I quote one of them at you?
Well, you can, but I mean, but do they not see that this is positively absurd and rightfully people are laughing at it because of its otherworldliness?
You would think that they would have to be not that stupid, but probably the most prominent aggressive defender of these views is a guy called Richard Toll. And this is quoting a tweet of him in a debate from just a few months ago. 10K, which is 10 degrees Celsius, is less than the temperature distance between Alaska and Maryland, about equally rich, or between Iowa and Florida, about equally rich. Climate is not a primary driver of income.
Okay, but okay. Let me chime in if I can. If you don't have an environment left...
You ain't got an economy either. Exactly.
Do they not see the absurdity?
They don't see it. And this is a product of living in a discipline where making absurd assumptions to get over logical conundrums has become a way of life.
Is that because it's just easier, or is it because these people want to stay employed? What is going on? What's the mechanism?
I think a large
here?
Part of it is you don't need economists to have an economy.
Right.
Okay. You need engineers to have bridges. If engineers build bridges the same way economists do, there'd be people crashing into rivers all
daily.
Over the planet.
Right.
Okay. And engineering would be rapidly revised. The economy can go on regardless of what economic theory is.
Because people are economic actors and they
exists.
Have to.
Yeah. Right. If we don't have a theory of the economy, the theory still exists.
But then this army of thinkers, inverted commas, turns up and starts to skew things.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they thought they were defending capitalism against criticism, against socialism. So it was an ideological battle. And like in that sense, they won the battle, but they chose aspects of capitalism it doesn't have as the basis of their defense. If I was going to defend capitalism against socialism, I'd say capitalism generates more innovation, more variety. But equilibrium, that's the last thing capitalism achieves. Mm. You want equilibrium, you go to Russia in the 1970s. Okay, nothing changes, no matter how much you try. So they chose a bad ideological basis of defending capitalism. And then that vision of it as a equilibrium-achieving, smooth system, that became wedded into their vision of how the world should be. And they defend that against all comers, including the climate. Only the climate couldn't give a stuff about them either.
But so as you predicted the great financial crisis, the reason you're jumping up and down now is because using the same rationale, thinking about those models, you're saying actually a financial crisis you can get over. Mm. However, a planetary crisis is something very different.
We can't. We can't get over it. My problem is I can't see us doing anything to stop this until it becomes obvious that it's happening, even to economists, even to climate change deniers. Humans don't respond before a crisis collectively. Individuals do. The whole system, we continue the same old momentum. When it breaks down, we're going to have to know who's responsible, as well as who not to listen to, and as well as who to prosecute. And economists fall into that latter category. Not all of them, but these ones definitely. And I think any mainstream economist, any conventional economist, should be shooting these guys down. You cannot allow them to make assumptions that are that dangerous, that bad. But because the whole history of economics is letting crazy assumptions be accepted, they let this stuff get published. It should never have been published.
The Limits to Growth was a small book that appeared in 1972. It's only 150 pages, but its main content is 12 scenarios for the world from 1970 to the year 2100. Six of these scenarios are sad scenarios where something goes wrong in the world in the 21st century. Too much pollution, too little resources, too little food, too many people, that type of thing. Six of the scenarios are good scenarios, positive scenarios, where humanity manages to achieve some degree of sustainable well-being in the 21st century. At the time in 1972, we did not know enough to tell which of those 12 scenarios was the most likely one. So all we could say, and that's what we say in the book, that mankind, please shy away from the sad scenarios, you know, try to aim for the good, sustainable scenarios. Today, 50 years later, we know very much more about how to forecast global development. So we know very much more today about what scenario we are actually going to follow over the next at least 30 to 40 years. And we can see that humanity is actually on full move towards one of the sadder scenarios, namely the climate crisis scenario. The other thing we have learned over the last 50 years is that the human response to the warning from Limits to Growth has not been heeded very much. Yes, there has been some progress. Yes, we now have environmental ministries and we have some NGOs that are fighting the good fight. But by and large, you know, we're still doing business as usual. The most obvious examples of non-action during the last 50 years is the climate and the resource scene. You know, the world economy has continued growing, as has the population, all the time since we published the book. And the burden on the planet at this point in time is very many times higher than what it was in 1970, in spite of our warning.
We're putting roughly four times the load on the biosphere that we were back then. So to change direction now is far harder. The dangers are now far closer because we've already warmed the climate substantially and there's a momentum to this which they don't seem to understand. Well, simplest, I mean, in terms of population, back in the 1970s, we're talking about 2 billion people. Now we're talking closer to 8. We're talking the increase in income, which was obviously China and India had to improve in income, but of course, improving in income means increasing in energy, means increasing waste and pollution also going into the environment. And in terms of the amount of the planet, which is actually devoted to the human species alone, apparently of the, this is me quoting scientist research, the total mass of mammals on the planet, 95% of it is either humans or animals who have grown to serve humans. The other 5% is the wild kingdom. Now, we've taken up 95% of the space. And when you then look at the burden we're putting on the planet, in terms of how much the planet can renew every year, we passed the point where we were taking out what the planet could renew every year roughly 40 years ago. We're now, according to what's called the human ecological footprint, which is one way to try to measure the impact we have on the planet, we're using 1.6 planets per year. Something has to break. Something has to give. It isn't a case of, you know, this might happen in the future, but the financial crisis is approaching. We've already started to damage the climate on a grand scale. And they are saying that the impacts of an incredible increase in temperature is going to be trivial. So one of Nordhaus's predictions is that the ideal level of global temperature in terms of offsetting the cost of global warming versus the cost of minimizing global warming, balancing the two, the ideal temperature, and this is in his Nobel Prize speech, is 4 degrees warmer than pre-industrial levels, about 3 degrees more than today. Now, that's what he calls optimal. That's actually, you look in his chart, look for the Nobel Prize speech by Nordhaus in 2018, that his optimal trajectory has us peaking at a temperature 4 degrees above pre-industrial levels by 2140. And he says, when you look at them and say, what impact will that have on GDP? He says, GDP in 2040, if temperature rises by 4 degrees, will be roughly 4% less than it would have been in the complete absence of global warming. So he's saying global warming is that trivial, literally, only worth a 4 degree decline in GDP in about 120 years.
Do you find it peculiar that it's always offset against cost? Because fundamentally what we're talking about, money, which is a man-made concept. This word cost, what do you mean the cost of offsetting?
Well, fundamentally what they mean is we put our resources into, rather than producing more waffle irons and coffee cups, we put the effort into technology which can mitigate climate change. So we put more money into nuclear power stations and solar power than we do into coal. We maybe build scrubbing devices to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere rather than producing more mobile phones. So it's saying we're getting goods which are not produced for their consumption benefit, but to reduce damages. And that's what they see as the cost. And he argued the cost of, if we go down the route of minimizing global warming to only 4 degrees versus 6, which is what he thinks has happened if we don't do mitigation, then that will cost $19 trillion. Now, $19 trillion is a lot of money, but it's about the size of the American economy will fall courtesy of a 4 degree increase in global temperature. If you said if it rises by 6, it's $23 trillion, which is about the size of the US economy. Now, that's assuming there won't be an economy.
But that's the killer point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, it's angels on a pinhead. You can have all these debates, but the point is that if you trash your environment, And this is the hubris.
Yeah, it is hubris.
Actually,
it is
no
hubris.
Having any, it's a Mad Max scenario.
Yeah.
And we end up walking around saying, well, who came up with these ideas?
Yeah, and that's the trouble is we often blame people like the Koch brothers and Exxon and so on for knowing what the likely outcome is going to be and hiding it. That's, you'll see, you know, there are court cases on that front right now. So these are people whose, you know, it's in their financial interests to minimize the apparent dangers of climate change.
But where are you laying the blame?
I'm blaming it on the economists as well, not on leaving the Koch brothers out of this or Exxon, but I'm saying it's the ideological belief that they have that capitalism can handle any disturbance. Their vision of capitalism is a system which is so flexible and so innovative that you can, you know, smash it with a baseball bat and it'll bounce right back up again, nice and healthy. So they don't think there's anything you can do to capitalism which can damage it. And what they're talking about is raising the global temperature so much that civilization, I think, will collapse. What they don't seem to understand is many, many things. But we have been living through a 10,000-year period of relatively stable climate. The variation in climate between 10,000 years ago and now is no more than 1 degree Celsius. We're actually being on a cooling trend until the industrial period. And that period meant we didn't have to move about as nomadic tribes all the time, getting away from changes in climate, changes in animals, changes in crops and so on, caused by dramatic variation in the climate. That gave us time to develop, you know, first of all, Sumerian civilization, Egyptian, Chinese, et cetera, et cetera. The stability of the climate may have been, probably was, we can't run an experiment to find out, was a major factor in us developing the societies we have now, which are fundamentally sedentary. We live in one place, we build in one place.
But the cynic would say to you,
yeah,
and they, by the way, call themselves pragmatists, yeah, what's wrong with this, Steve? We just move. Alaska looks all right, we'll move up there. What,
yeah,
do you think about that?
Slight trouble. We'll move faster than topsoil gets created. Again, the level of unreality.
Detail.
Yeah, details. We need soil to grow crops.
We need land now? We're back to land.
Yeah, I know. So when you look at these studies by the economists using the idea that you can use current GDP temperature data to predict what's going to happen with climate change, they then talk about the regions that are colder than optimal, and the optimal temperature, in their opinion, is an average of 12 degrees. So how do you pronounce it? Stavanger?
Stavanger.
Well, do very nicely because it'll get warmer, you know, whereas Mexico City might do worse because it'll get warmer and it's already past the 12-degree average. And they simply say some parts that are colder than the optimum are going to get warmer and therefore improve. Parts that are warmer than the optimum are going to get hotter again and fall out. And overall, there's going to be this trivial change. When we look around the globe, the parts of the globe that are going to benefit most, particularly Siberia. Now, I'm sure Vladimir is going to let us all move to Siberia. And I'm sure we're going to find plenty of topsoil there. Once the tundra all melts, then of course instantly there's going to be topsoil forming and it's going to be just as deep as the topsoil in Iowa. And we can grow all the crops in Siberia rather than Iowa. The lack of realism is just breathtaking. I don't know how anybody could read that stuff and say anything other than this is insane. But this had to pass referees and academic journals to be published.
And don't want to be conspiratorial, but is there another agenda?
No.
Are you sure about that?
I've been in the economics departments as a profession for 30 years, as a student before that. They sincerely believe this stuff. And that's the trouble.
It's even more dangerous than if it was a hidden agenda. At least if they were being funded by someone, we could stop that.
That's right. You can pay them. If they don't believe it, you can pay them to say something else. When they believe it, you can't pay them to shut up. And the trouble is they're wrong, but they believe this with such zealotry. They fight anybody who comes on and criticizes them on the grounds of realism.
For people who sit here now and feel quite helpless, how do we then take on these people who genuinely believe, they're sincere in their belief, they genuinely believe that they're doing the right thing, and we as householders sit here and have listened to your logic and think, yep, all right, I'm on board. What do we do?
Unfortunately, it's a bit like asking somebody in the Titanic, what do you do when the captain thinks icebergs are nice fluffy clouds that are going to clean the ship as he drives through them? You killed the captain. You've got to have a mutiny, and that's why the Extinction Rebellion is a mutiny.
Right.
Okay? And for good reason, we trust experts. We trust experts, and there are disciplines which indeed are experts, engineers, quite a few in this room, I hope. I'll trust an engineer when I cross a bridge any day, okay? We've trusted economists. We've given the same thing to economists, believing they're experts on the economy. They're not experts on the economy. They're experts on a model of the economy, which is neat, plausible and wrong, and trying to break through them is just impossible. They continue reproducing themselves. And yet we hand over control and management of so much of the society to economists. And that's why we've got to this point where Extinction Rebellion has developed. So I think the only thing we can do is literally that vision of a mutiny against a captain who doesn't know what the hell he's doing.
And because the enemy is, as you've described it, so formless, where best to put our attention? Because I understand that Extinction Rebellion are doing what they're doing because it's a start, but not everybody, not every householder can go out and do that and get involved in stopping most cities. Where do you focus your attention?
I would be focusing it on putting as much of our resources as possible in the developing alternative energy systems. And I've been persuaded by my engineering friends that things like thorium nuclear reactors must be developed, solar. And I've got arguments in both directions whether solar can actually replace it. We have to drastically reduce our energy load on the planet. The transportation system would move away from individual vehicles towards mass transportation, minimizing travel in general. A drastic fall in the energy consumption of the planet, I think, is necessary. And it's not easy for an individual to do that. We live in a system where you simply have to slot into the manufacturing and distribution systems that currently exist. So it's not the sort of thing an individual can do. It's why a movement like Extinction Rebellion to change direction is necessary. So to me, the best thing we can do is get engineers to take over economics. But it's very, very late in the process of understanding capitalism.
How long have we got?
20 years. When you look at the level of temperature rise and the feedbacks we're now seeing, there are some scientists who are saying that there is a what they call a period of tipping cascades that are going to happen. Past a certain point, the Arctic summer ice disappears. We're getting pretty close to that. That could cause Greenland to melt completely. That could cause the West Antarctic ice shelf. That could change the thermohaline circulation that is the major reason why Europe is as warm as it is. All these various massive elements of the climate are under threat. And what we should have done is look at it and say, we evolved in this very stable period of temperature. It's our responsibility to manage the climate so it doesn't move outside those bounds. And it's also our responsibility to the other species on the planet to give them space. We've done neither of those things. And what economists are saying is rather than paying heed to staying within that bound and respecting the other creatures, we should just continue growing exponentially. And the end result of that is crisis.
Steve Keen, thank you very much for your time.